Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for braving the frozen tundra to come here today. We're continuing our talk about this book. If anybody doesn't have it, I don't know who deserves the credit. Somebody deserves a lot of credit. They've actually printed out 3 copies. Who? Ye did this? Thank you so much, Ye. You printed out the book for people who might want it and don't have it, since it's not, you know, like available from a bookstore or Amazon anymore. It's out of print. So when Lama Kathy's on the road, meditation instructors and mentors give Dharma talks. And this one, interestingly enough, she actually got us out of order a little bit. We talked about it. She kind of gave a talk about this chapter, kind of. And she said, well, should we just change the whole schedule? And when we talked about it, the thought was, actually, it doesn't hurt to hear this stuff again. So if there's a repetition that annoys you, please forgive. And of course, you know, every person comes at this. There is a teaching that has its own continuity and shape and form, of course, but everybody expresses things in a slightly different way. And so now you'll get my take on what this chapter says. The first thing is that I noticed is that this is called fertile ground. I immediately had images of fertility in my mind. She didn't say that, I promise you. And little bodhicitta babies running throughout the universe because of our activity. So there's an image for you. Interestingly enough, each of these kind of sections has a title, like this one is including oneself in a tradition. Well, we get to the few pages back, and there is one actually called Fertile Ground. It is the shortest section in the whole thing, yet they titled it the whole chapter Fertile Ground. I thought that was interesting. It made me want to pay attention to it and maybe say it first instead of a couple pages back. The way I want to do this is to kind of walk through the chapter, because there's a lot to unpack here. And really, there's probably not enough time and attention in one session to contemplate each of the points Bokar Rinpoche is making. But at the end, I've kind of put together a simple 4-step process that gets at a lot of what he's talking about that any of us can use for our practice. And so I'll walk through this, and then at the end, offer you the 4 points that I came up with that might be helpful in your practice. Before we begin, though, it's our tradition to begin with a prayer. And actually, that's part of the chapter. It's the last thing in the chapter. He says, okay, now that I've told you all this, it's always good to start your practice with a prayer or some mantra. And Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, when he is taught meditation, always says that good meditation has 3 parts. The first part is to start with an altruistic motivation, which is motivation that this would benefit yourself and all beings, and realize that that's why you're doing it. You're doing it not for all the side effects. There are a lot of good side effects with the Dharma, but really keep your eye on the prize, which is there's ultimate benefit. And having an aspiration to achieve ultimate benefit for yourself and for others kind of keeps your eye on the prize and keeps you from saying, oh, that was good or that was bad. So you realize that whatever you do when you're pointed in this direction actually is just bigger than what you're feeling in the moment might be. And that's actually an important training for meditation practice, to let go of the ulterior motives for it. The second part of practice is, of course, to practice properly. And the way we practice properly is to get instructions from somebody who knows how to do it, rather than making up our own thing. One thing that Tibetan teachers have noticed about Western students is we're a little over-independent. We have this independent streak that actually has some healthy aspects to it, but it also creates obstacles in terms of us really learning things that can help us a lot, because we think we know stuff already that we don't know at all. So we learn to practice properly from somebody who knows how to do that. And then at the end is to realize, to take a moment and recognize that even if you spent 5 or 10 minutes, or even 1 minute or 2 minutes, there's been a lot of benefit just from that. And to not sort of cling to the radiance of all that benefit, but instead to dedicate it to others and to make sure that you haven't just done it selfishly and that you're not setting up the habit of selfishness. It's really important. So those three parts, aspiration, altruistic aspiration, practicing properly, and dedication. If you can do all three things, even if your meditation practice is brief and you have some kind of feeling that it's not the best or something, doesn't matter. If you can do those three things, it is the best. So with that in mind, what we do usually as a beginning prayer is something that encapsulates all that, which is the four-line refuge prayer. And the four-line refuge prayer, we chant it in Tibetan, but what it really is saying is that we're taking refuge in the Buddha. Buddha means awakened. And there's the admirable figure, Shakyamuni, who we all know about, you know, the guy in the middle of the shrine. And we admire him and all that. But awakened is also the nature of your own mind. So with the aspiration that we can come to enough rest and clarity, we want to take refuge in the Buddha nature that actually is a part of us. We take refuge in the Dharma, which is the teachings that lead us to that realization. Because I can tell you about it, and that, you know, that's good. But for you to experience it for yourself, that's the idea. That's what we aim for. Because knowing about it is different than knowing it. The map is not the territory. And the third thing we take refuge in is the Sangha, which is the community. There are two communities, actually. It's all one thing, but we break it up two ways. One is what's called the enlightened Sangha. And those are the Buddhas that we depend on. You know, their kindness and compassion is limitless and therefore is present to us even if we don't see them physically. They're as present to us now as Shakyamuni was to a Sangha 2,600 years ago. That's the enlightened Sangha. The ordinary Sangha is us. We take care of each other with kindness and compassion. And and jokes and whatever's good that we have. So if you know this four-line refuge prayer in Tibetan, please chant it along with me. If you don't, that's okay. Just hold in your...
I have these, so I was thinking...
Sure.
So if you, for those who, if you'd like a book to be able to follow along, because you don't know the prayer yet, could you raise your hand?
That's a good idea.
I figured we have
them. Yeah. So if you wish, chant along with me. And if not, just follow along in your heart, recognizing that these three jewels of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are a true refuge for you. Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyam Suchi Dagi Jin So Gi Pe Sunam Gi Drola Penshir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Gi Pe Sonam Gi Rola Pinshir Sanje Drupar Shok Sanje Chudang Soki Choknam La Changchu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Taki jin so gi pe sunam gi drola pin shir sanje drupar sho. Thank you. So where do we start? Well, we start with recognizing how lucky we are to be here. We're lucky to be humans, for one thing. We're lucky to be in this country where we have a great degree of material comfort. We have a really privileged place in history and in the world. And we have to understand that this didn't just happen accidentally. There are causes and conditions that have created this life that we're living and this place that we're living in. And even the fact that you're here hearing the Dharma, which is extraordinary, and it's rare, even in this day and age where it seems to proliferate, it's actually hearing Dharma talks is not that common, if you think about it. A lot more people see football games on Sunday than hear Dharma talks. And I'm entertained by those myself, but there's a difference of what I'm occupying my mind with. So the thing to recognize about that, though, is also that it's transitory. It's one of the first teachings of the Buddha. It's impermanent. You can't think about this lasting forever. And the important part of that is what we're doing right now, right in this moment, is creating the causes and conditions for the next moment. Bokar Rinpoche says in this chapter that the reason that we are living with such material prosperity in the West is because of generosity in past lives. Well, why meditate if we've gotten this? Well, the truth is that we're still nervous about holding on to what we've got that we don't want to lose. We're still nervous and anxious about getting what we don't have that we want to have. We carry around a flood of thoughts with us that totally create what's called grasping. We want to really hold on to stuff, and it slips through our fingers. Eventually, we all know this. And we really want to push stuff away that we're afraid of, that we don't like, and so on and so forth. And it really doesn't work because stuff happens, right? So he says, because it's transitory, we actually have to appreciate it a lot. And we got to be really attentive or mindful so that what we're doing is actually creating causes and conditions for the benefit of ourselves and others going forward. Obviously, the future doesn't exist yet. All we can do is to create kind of the setup for the flow of life energy to go into something that continues to benefit ourselves and others. And the ultimate benefit is what we call enlightenment. He's got a good definition for meditation, which is also kind of a definition of enlightenment that I'd like to read. If I can find it again. Knowing how to maintain one's mind in its own essence, as it is, without being distracted by either outer phenomena or inner thoughts, is precisely what we mean by meditation. In other places, they'll tell you when you are resting in your mind's own essence, that's a moment of awakening. And when all those moments string together and become the way you are, that's what's called an enlightened being. The good news is there are enlightened beings around. It's not just Buddha 2,600 years ago. There are living people around who you can go see that are enlightened beings. It's pretty cool. It's so inspiring. And, you know, to take the most public example, look at the Dalai Lama. Do you ever look at a YouTube of the Dalai Lama and just wonder, where did he get that? How is he like that? When you take the situation that he's in and has been in since he was a relatively young person, and he turns out like that, you have to be amazed. I am amazed. And I feel like, well, when I grow up, I want to be like him. That's what refuge is. When you take refuge in someone who's enlightened, it's like realizing that they have a kind of a life that you want to live into yourself. And Bokar Rinpoche talks about taking refuge as being the first step in creating a fertile ground for meditation. The whole idea is that we're going to lessen some of the coarsest, most difficult worries and concerns that we have. And by doing that, by creating a little bit smoother ground, it's kind of like starting a garden and pulling the rocks out. It makes it easier to grow stuff. Okay? So taking refuge is that. We talk a lot about devotion here. He talks about it in here. I want to tell you something that I found elsewhere about this. There are actually four stages because, you know, well, here's why I want to say this. When I first started being around Tibetan Buddhism, I was totally impressed and a little bit overwhelmed by what I saw as these people who were both perfectly intelligent about their lives and perfectly devoted at the same time. And I couldn't understand how they gave themselves away like that and still maintained any usefulness at all in life, and that troubled me. And at some point along the line, I got a teaching about that that I've kept around. And it's taught that there are four levels of this. This is important for this idea of taking refuge. The first level is admiration. It's like me watching a YouTube of the Dalai Lama. And curiosity. So it's like I admire him because he's a refugee and look what happened. And look how many people he's benefiting, even though he carries this history with him. It's amazing to me. So I admire him, and I'm curious about, okay, how did he do that? And that's devotion. Allowing your admiration and allowing your curiosity to be really an alive thing instead of just cutting it off, that's the first level. Once you kind of get through this stage of curiosity and admiration, and you realize it's possible for yourself, there's longing. There's this deep longing. Every religion talks about it. There's a longing for achieving your version of that in your lifetime. That longing is devotion. And you see it in people. It's very touching. It's very meaningful. It's worth supporting. It's worth experiencing fully. Once you get a little bit of experience, which you will, because a lot of people have been doing this for 2,600 years and it's worked hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times. And like I said, you can see some living examples right now. And once you see that, you come to a place of deep trust in the path. So, you know, that includes yearning because you really get on the cushion. You really want to do this. And it includes curiosity because you got to still learn and you got to still grow. But you have kind of a deep trust. Yep, this is going to get me there. And then the last stage, the fourth stage, is when you have an actual experience. And when you have an experience, you have an experience. You know in your own bones. And it's a remarkable thing, and that's called irreversible or unshakable confidence. And when you have irreversible or unshakable confidence, you can be pretty quiet about things. That's the interesting thing. Rather than becoming a street preacher about it, you just are a quiet presence and you're unshakable. And now and then you see a way that you gain some insight into a situation, you can be helpful. Or you gain some insight into a situation and you realize you are best just praying, but you have insight. That's the point. You do the right thing in the right way at the right time to the right people. And that's the activity of a Buddha, and it's limitless. And we all have that nature that's capable of it. Pretty great. So, in a sense, there's a couple things packed in there. One is including yourself in a tradition that works. My own experience is that you can't make it up as you go along and get where you want to go. That's how I wound up here. The relief of coming in here for me was simply that I had run in. I'd always been a spiritual person. It's just something I was born with. And I ran a long way, had a lot of experience. But I kind of ran into a box canyon, and I knew it wasn't a dark night of the soul. It was a box canyon. I was trapped, I wasn't going any further. I just had taken an unfruitful path. No fault of my own. I just had to make it up as I went along because the tradition that I was in, kind of the lineage of this stuff had gotten broken. And I heard about this place. I'd actually visited once before that. And I realized it was all about a living lineage. I knew that somehow. And I called up and I told Lama Kathy my long story. And she said, "Well, I think I can help you." I said, "Good." And she said, "You'll just have to start all over from the beginning." I said, "Excellent." And I did. And the reason I did was she also said enough to let me know that I wasn't going to run into any box canyons anymore. This was going to take me as far as I could possibly go without any obstacles other than the ones I create by my own mental states. So in attaching yourself to a tradition, to the Dharma, Dharma meaning a tradition of teaching that works, is really, really important. When you attach yourself to the tradition, Bokar Rinpoche says that there are three things that are declared, so to speak, by the tradition, by this tradition. The first is, through meditation, all suffering can be transformed into happiness. He's unequivocal about this. Through meditation, the conflicting emotions which agitate our mind can be transformed into primordial, non-dual knowledge. Through meditation, samsara can be transformed into nirvana, which means the ordinary world is transformed into awakened reality. So it's important, if you want to do those things, that sounds pretty good to me, by the way. It's important to get good teaching, to aim yourself in the right direction. That's that whole thing about making an altruistic aspiration before you practice, practicing properly, and then dedicating the merit, because you're not alone in this endeavor. Why is it like that? I mean, we're all born with good intelligence. We're born with a lot of resources. You know, it's like this seems to be a little bit, you know, extra, a little bit much, a lot of hard work. It's remarkable, actually, how much hard work once you start digging, you know. And what Bokar Rinpoche says is that we've got this problem. When we sit down to meditate, first we're working with our mind. Our mind is mostly composed of a stream of thinking based on inner and outer circumstances. The inner circumstances are memories of the past, concerns about the future, and thinking really hard about what I'm doing in the present. This is problematic because we don't get any peace. We don't get to rest. Apparently, what happens when a mind is well rested, different qualities can actually start to arise. It's what we're going for, is those qualities. And then there are the outer circumstances, which have to do with our six senses, which are obviously feeling, taste, smell, seeing, hearing, and mental consciousness. You know, what we think about those things once we feel them. There's instructions from Guru Rinpoche. That's Guru Rinpoche up there. We hold him in high esteem. Some people call him the second Buddha. And he calls this, this one key verse out of a teaching he gave on self-liberation. He said, three simple insights will introduce you to mind's true nature. First, thoughts in the past are empty of any permanent substance. They ultimately vanish, leaving no trace behind. The past is vanished. Our thoughts about the past, they come up, but they go away. There's nothing there. And you need to, when you're ruminating about what happened, you need to remember to see it for what it is. That's what it means to see its essence. Simple as that. It's not like this big mystical thing where you got to wear a special hat. It's not like that. Although he's wearing a special hat. That's about something else. And he says, they ultimately vanish, leaving no trace behind. Second, thoughts in the future are empty of any permanent substance. They offer no hint that they will ever arise. How many times do we think really hard about what's coming and then that's not what happens? Like, for me, almost every time. Third, thoughts in the present are empty of any permanent substance. They cannot be made to abide anywhere. How many of you meditate and just watch your thoughts without attaching to them? I mean, is that part of your practice? If you do, where do they come from? Where do they stay? Where do they go? Just looking at them that simply is enough to understand the nature of present thoughts. They don't abide anywhere. They don't have substance. They don't stay. They're not like this table. This will be here for a while. Thoughts about this table will not. Then he says, so why do you cling to the past, present, and future with so many hopes and fears? Let them go. By examining, practicing thoughts as unborn. That's what they mean by unborn. That kind of word in the middle of a sentence always confused me. What do you mean unborn? That's what they mean by unborn. They don't come from anywhere. They don't go anywhere. They don't abide anywhere. So by examining and practicing thoughts as unborn, there's recognition. What happens? Well, if you just let them go, whether it's a flood of thoughts or whether it's relatively few thoughts, and it's different on every day. There are spaces, there are gaps. And in those gaps, there's something that's kind of indescribable. Most meditation teachers say it's like sunlight in a clear blue sky. You can see that out there. I saw that when I was coming in. They're inseparable. And your mind is like that, where it's vast and open and unclouded, and things go through it all the time. Birds and clouds and airplanes and all, they just go through it. But you're not the thoughts or the clouds or the airplanes or any of that. You're the sky. And the sky is completely interpenetrated with light, so that you can see that's clarity, that's luminosity. Yeah, I think there are some people that kind of glow. Maybe it's because they really do this meditation really well. But there's light in our minds, and if we meditate, we can catch it. So That's our situation. We try to get what we don't have. We try to avoid what we don't want. And we don't like a lot of what we do have. It's weird. And that's the situation. We ruminate about our pasts and we think about what happened to us and all that kind of stuff and how it left us in one condition or another. We worry about our future and our mind doesn't rest. Now, I realize as practical experience goes, we really need actually to learn from the past and we actually have to make some plans for where we're going. I mean, even meditations like that, you have to plan to be on your cushion every day if you're going to do that. But once those things have served their purpose, you can drop it. You don't have to keep, perseverating over and over and over again. Did the job, done. And on we go. It's really important to understand that ethics in particular, not harming yourself or others and practicing virtue as much as possible, actually clears those rocks out of the garden of your mind so that you can have some fertile ground. So as we go through our days, it's really good to be mindful of how the time is for us and how we react and respond to it. We have some choices. Again, that's why it's good to always start with the aspiration of what we call bodhicitta or altruistic view. It's because you'll get in that habit and you will respond to things differently. And then when you do, your mind will be less upset. And when your mind's less upset, it's easier to meditate. And when it's easier to meditate, you'll catch glimpses of that sunlight in the blue sky. So it's all a virtuous circle like that. You don't just kind of leave one part out. It's like it all goes together. And I think that's a valuable thing. Boker Rinpoche says it's a lot easier if you go up in a mountain cave and seclude yourself and you don't have the distractions of noise and family and all the other stuff. But he realizes that that's pretty impractical for most of us. And so he talks about taking on, even during the day, smells that you smell and sounds that you hear, feelings that you feel and so on, as something to rest your mind on. You don't have to just rest your mind on your breath and use that to avoid what you're feeling, seeing, touching. If it's really noisy and obnoxious somewhere where you are, you can rest your mind on that noisy, obnoxious sound and hear it very clearly. And as long as you're hearing it really clearly, you're resting your mind there really well. When it gets fuzzy and wavy, you realize that you're distracting yourself with something else and you're running away from life. That's good meditation in the middle of a city. We can take anything as our object of meditation. It doesn't just have to be our breath or a statue of the Buddha. This is something we can apply all the time. And the capability is there all the time. The thing to notice when you're doing that is that, like, when I hear high-pitched, overwrought music, it's very annoying to me. I really don't like it. But if I take it as an object of meditation, everybody thinks I'm just being a saint because they know I don't like it. Not at all. I've just changed the game a lot. So instead of judging it as, I don't like this, I have to get away, I drop that thought and I just let listening be. And it's a whole different thing. Dropping the judgment is the game. Likewise, when you're having meditation practice formally or informally, if you have some thought, this is it, when it's going like you think it's going really good, or this is not it, when you think it's going really bad, you're thinking about meditation, it's a judgment and a label that you put on it, drop it. If you're meditating, you don't have that judgment of this is it or this is not it. And so you can use your own thoughts as they arise, even as the object of your meditation, just whatever. And you begin to see whatever it is clearly, and you begin to see whatever you feel, or feel whatever you feel more acutely, taste whatever tastes you're tasting. That's why there's all like Japanese tea ceremony. That's all about being in the moment of tea. It's fascinating. I have a friend who was like taught tea ceremony at Naropa. It was interesting to hear her talk about it. Amazing. It's profound meditation. Everything in our life can be like that. We're, of course, inclined not to do it. And we get thrown way off, but it doesn't matter. Once we notice that we get thrown way off, we can just say, oh, I got thrown way off, and just come right back. So this becomes kind of a way of life. This way of life actually is what creates the fertile ground for meditation. It's meditation that creates the ground for meditation. Go figure. So before we come to an end, I do want to share these 4 points with you. I had intended on making this a little more interactive, but I wanted to unpack too much. So I apologize for not doing that. All right. These are four. This is something from Talopa, who is like the progenitor of this lineage. He was the guy that got the original insight that we call Mahamudra that got passed on to Naropa and to Marpa and to Gampopa and to Milarepa and then the first Karmapa that we have an unbroken lineage of. So I hold these particular instructions dear to my heart. And wanted to share them with you. So he's got kind of Form A and Form B, all right? Form A, Talopa's instructions. Rest the mind in the natural state without attempting to alter anything. Let thoughts dissolve like clouds in a clear blue sky. That's his instructions. It sounds pretty straightforward, and sometimes we can even do it for like a second, and sometimes we can't. Sometimes during retreat, we can do it for a little longer time. But in terms of our actual lives, there's this Form B that gets more practical. It's basically what happens in post-meditation, like what happens when your toilet gets plugged. Or a good friend says you're selfish. Or your boss says you're getting laid off again. Or what happens, this is personal for me, what happens when you watch the evening news and fill in the blank for yourself? You know, the question is, where's your clear blue sky then, bucko? Where did it even go for you guys now that I just said that? You probably all thought about the evening news. I mean, it's... So, when that happens, Talopa's plan A, you know, just gazing in the clear blue sky, enjoying the quality of light in it. It might as well be written in hieroglyphics. You're not going to understand it. I don't understand it. I'm engaged with the stuff that I'm seeing, the greed that I'm seeing, the malfeasance that I'm seeing, and all those things that are going to raise my hackles. 10 years ago, Kempo Kartha Rinpoche came, and he gave a teaching on Kempo Gangshar's Liberating Whatever You See. It was a great teaching. And the main instruction is bring all obstacles to the path, and that includes plug toilets, unfaithful friends, bad news, so on and so forth. So he said, you know, when all these obscurations, when all these obstacles get your panties in a bunch and things are really twisted up and pinching and A isn't working, he gave basically Talopa's plan B. So let's say the evening news gave me my daily dose of anxiety mixed with malice. I'm anxious about bad decisions I see being made and malice towards the greedy robber barons that are making it. And how do I deal with that? And Talopa said, you can't use thoughts. You cannot use thoughts to release the fetters of your mind. But we have to start there because that's what we've got. We have to start where we are. So the trick is to start the thinking mind and transition into a state of awareness. How do we do that? 4-step process. First step, apply basic ethics. Catch yourself in the state of harsh thoughts. I have a witness here today who will tell you this is not easy for me. I can get to the point of, you know, throwing things at my television set sometimes, you know. But that's the first step, is catch yourself in the act of harsh thoughts and strong emotions and replace them with loving kindness and compassion. You can do some Tonglen for whatever you're seeing there. Do it for yourself. Do it for the benighted souls that are engaged in this really unfortunate behavior. It's a very dualistic approach. It's self and other. It's still you and the other. This isn't enlightenment, but it helps. That's step one. We have to start with where we are, so we start with that. The second step is to get back on the meditation cushion and cultivate some calm abiding. In other words, start watching your thoughts and just let them go instead of holding on to them. Whatever good or bad thoughts are arising, just observe them as they are over there and bring yourself back to one point of concentration. It's important. Don't try to conquer your thoughts and emotions. And don't become attached to them either if you think they're good ones. That's all just your judgments and labels. Let them go. You can use your breath. You can use an object. You can use meditation without an object. You can use awareness of awareness. Whatever meditation method you like at that point, just do it. Still dualistic, because it's still you and the other. The third step is to use your guru's or your teacher's instructions. So now we've recognized our thing, we've done some compassion and kindness, we calmed ourselves down, and we're ready for a little insight because we're a little calmer. And that's where we begin to recognize the nature of these thoughts that are crossing our mind, good, bad, and indifferent, and that they don't come from anywhere, they don't go anywhere, and they don't abide anywhere. They're empty. That's what emptiness means. They don't have particular qualities that you can name and point to and even make useful. Talopa said, "The agitation of thoughts that arise in the mind are calmed the instant you see the mind's true nature." Now you can see all those thoughts that were really, really disturbing and that they're empty of any permanent existence. They're going to fade away anyway, so let them. That's the thing. When you read a Dharma text and they talk about reifying something, that's partly what they're talking about. We don't let the thoughts do what they do, which is arise and float along and fall away. We grab a hold of them and bring them back up, and we try to make them real for us because we have some attachment to them, whether it's negative or positive. So when you're doing shamatha, just let them go. And then the fourth step is to combine the calm abiding with the insight, the letting go with understanding that what you're letting go actually doesn't have any permanent existence anyway. And when you do that, that's what Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche calls co-emergent wisdom. In other words, wisdom, which is something you know cognitively, arises in this space of emptiness, which is open and spacious and full of light, instead of having the object of a thought, this is enlightenment, you know? It's like, no, it's just, there's space and light. It feels pretty good. And when that happens, what they say is that it produces a spontaneous burst of compassion. I'm working on that. But that's why when you meet Kenpo Kartha Rinpoche or the Dalai Lama or His Holiness Karmapa or so on, and so on, it's just, there's an energy that just rolls off them, and they are not even trying. Most of the time, they don't know you're there. I mean, not that they're ignoring you, but they're not ignoring you either. It's just how it is. It's because of that. A burst of compassion, non-dualistic compassion that we aspired to in the first step, boom, just appears, and it's just there. And it's there for you and for everybody, and that's that altruistic aspiration. I'm going to do this for myself and others. It actually really happens. And we have people it happened to, like these people who pointed out these four steps, are telling you how that's going to happen to us too, if we just kind of do our job. One last side note, and this is the end, is that when we do practice mantra practice, say Tara or Chenrezig, that's partly what's going on, is that we drop the idea of ourselves altogether and imagine ourselves as the bodhisattva of compassion. And to the degree that becomes non-dual, at a certain point, our mind quiets down, right? And this insight comes of how it all is just light in spaciousness. It doesn't have like some solid thing to accept or reject. The qualities of that Buddha actually are born in us, even just for a moment, in a burst. And that's why we do it, and we do it a lot. We're creating a habit for our minds to be able to identify with our enlightened nature rather than all the discursive thoughts that we entertain as being reality. So anyway, I've talked a lot, too much. I apologize for that. There's a couple minutes left, though, if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to, or comments. I'm happy to try to answer questions or enjoy comments. Hi.
Thank you, Eric. Actually, I have a request.
Yes.
Could you write up the 4 points from Tilopa?
Yes.
For us? I took a note, but if you could write it up.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
And just put them like on the e-list or something?
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
Just couldn't keep up with this, sorry.
Yeah, I understand.
The other one, kind of dumb question, but what is the object of the meditation? Sorry.
Oh, okay. So when we're doing shamatha, we often use our breath as an object. The object's whatever we rest our mind on. But if you want to, you can use a styrofoam cup as an object, or if you're mind is mostly involved in a noisy space, you can use the sound as an object. The idea is that rather than judging it or having a commentary or a story about anything, you just see it as it is, hear it for what it is, feel it for what it is, whatever, without judging it, without telling a story about it. And then when thoughts come up, let them go and just return to clearly experiencing the object. The object could be a flame, candle flame, could be a statue of the Buddha, whatever. So the idea is that you can use any object the way you use your breath when you do shamatha. Does that make sense?
So it's something that you could relax with, or?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, is it like something that you could relax your mind onto, or how do you?
Yeah, well, that's the idea of shamatha, is you're relaxing your mind, so you have relaxed attention. So you've got that, it's not concentrated like, you know, real tight. It's really clear and aware, but it's relaxed.
Okay.
The way I think of it for me, I don't know if this will help or not, but if you go to the art museum, sometimes you sit on one of those benches in the gallery and you just kind of sit back and relax and just kind of gaze loosely at a painting and you see it really clearly, but without thinking about brush strokes and the artist and all that, you just enjoy the painting. So if you were using that for shamatha, thoughts would come about whatever, and you'd let the thoughts go and just go back to resting your gaze on the painting. That's, I don't know. Does that help?
Yes. Thank you, Eric.
Sure. It's good to see you.
So I have a question. You said you were talking about the unborn awareness or the unborn thought.
Yeah.
So one of the mind training things is rest your mind in the nature of unborn awareness.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how those two relate?
Yes.
Because I never really quite got unborn awareness, but what you said about thoughts made me sort of have a little bit of an aha moment, but I can't put it into words, so I'm hoping you can.
Right. Well, okay. Yeah. Okay, so like, when you say the word awareness, you're labeling something, right? And that label is just like any other label or judgment. And so if you have this, what shall I say, clear idea of what awareness is, you're kind of making it permanent and fixed, and this is what it is. right? Unborn awareness is saying, ah, there's awareness there. We all get it. There's feeling there. We all get it. We have that. There's continuity. In other words, we remember what we did yesterday, and we actually, even though it's interrupted by sleep and interrupted by dreaming and all that, we start off where we left off because there's continuity. And all those are part of mind, but they're just there. They appear. They don't have an existence as something we label and judge, whether it's good or bad or indifferent. In my opinion, in order to, we get a little anxious as humans, though. And we want to grab onto this thing we call a self. And so we start to think about our continuity and the way we feel life and the way our awareness is. And we call that me. There's a personality there and all of that. In the mind training slogans, as I understand them, and that's a small understanding, not a big one, is when you're resting your mind in unborn awareness, is you're letting all that self-concept go. Okay, awareness is there. Whatever we call it appears. And it floats around in there for a while, and then it disappears. It's just letting it be. So that there's not a grasping onto, this is my awareness. Does that make sense?
It's getting there.
It's the same thing with thoughts being unborn. If you really look at thoughts, you don't know where they came from. Right? And you can go back and back and back. This thought, produced that thought. But if you spend time doing that, you'll never get anywhere, because there isn't anywhere. Awareness itself is like that. So unborn awareness is awareness you're not grasping onto. You're just resting in.
Okay,
does that make sense?
It kind of does, yeah.
There's this kind of like, I think it's about this sense of self that we have. It's like my awareness. What the Lojong slogans are talking about is non-dual awareness. So they want you to, in order to experience the non-dual, just being in this great flow of extraordinary, yeah, extraordinariness. This is, you can't even talk about it, right? We kind of get nervous. We think we got to grab onto something, identify something in order to make it work, because we've got all these preferences. We've got stuff we want, we've got stuff we don't want, we've got stuff we don't care about, and we try to take that and mold it into a life that'll make us happy, and then the realization is it doesn't. So for Lojong, out of compassion for ourselves, we want to rest in the nature of unborn awareness, which is to say, let's not grab onto that anymore. As the Beatles famously said, let it be.
So kind of starting with thoughts, because it's our thoughts that string together awareness.
Yes.
So we can start.
Absolutely.
And eventually get to unborn awareness.
Yeah. Well, thoughts, yeah, right. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely correct. Thoughts is what we have. We're not mostly aware of our awareness anyway.
Right.
We get flashes of it sometimes. But even when we get flashes, it's important. I don't know about you, but for me, I'll say, ah, this is it. And boom, outer darkness.
Right.
Right away. So what he's saying is when you see that thought, this is it. That's just a thought about awareness. Let it go.
So it's groundlessness.
Yes.
We can go
and it's okay.
Yeah.
Because what they're also saying is when you experience that, you're going to get an extraordinary flash of compassion. Normally, being who I am, I might not have confidence in that But I do because I've seen it in actual people I know. You know? So I'm saying, okay, this is trustworthy. But that's the way I know it's trustworthy. It's not like I know.
More
sort of
thoughts.
And I'll
let go. Thank you.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Arvin.
Just a piggyback on that, wouldn't I mean, it's not the only one I can think of, but the most obvious to me would be doing a lock tongue to work with that and
sure,
developing or recognizing or whatever you want to call it, the unbridled awareness.
Yes. Okay. It is lock tongue.
Right. Okay.
That's what it is. Yeah. But the ultimate comes when you take this calm abiding mind,
right,
and lock tongue and
right,
let them just
right
then that's what's meant by sunlight in a clear sky.
Right
The calm abiding is like the clear sky,
right,
and the lock tongue is like light. And if you go outside, you can't separate the light from the sky, right.
But when you're first doing the lock tongue, I mean, you're starting with the thoughts.
You are.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are starting with thoughts.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
Right. Cool.
Hi.
Hey. I kind of like what you're talking about. I kind of like experienced it like this past week. So I remember last week when I was talking about my anger, how I was just so mad and angry for the whole week. I work for about 6 or 7 hours. So what I do at work is do the mantra the whole 6 or 7 hours. And while I was doing the mantra, I would realize that the thoughts that would arise, like you are right, aren't necessarily me, because the mantra is basically concentration, I guess. And these thoughts, it's so funny, they come up and it's like they try to get you to attach to them. They just come up and then they realize that you're not really bothered by it and just go away.
Yeah,
and they come back up like, you know, pay attention to them, and you just don't pay attention to them. They just go away. It's like little goblins. They just come up and just mess with you, but you just don't have to pay attention to them. They go away. But what I realized, though, over time, over the week, is I wanted to know what I really was. So I had to kind of break down what I was as a person, which was my ego, and really look at myself as information. And what you said is like thoughts really just arise and they really don't mean anything, they go away. That's kind of what my past is too, what I built up as myself as a person, what I think of myself. So I kind of just started breaking down myself and realizing that you are right. No self is really a real thing, because it's information that is dead and gone, that's no longer really relevant. It's ceaseless. So every moment that I exist, I'm continuously gathering information. But that information, too, is ceasing to be. So I just realized that no self is a real thing. And when you realize no self, it really is peace, because everything that flows through you really is nothing. And you just let go and you just a thing. I don't know. I don't really know what it is, but you just exist and it's cool.
It's awesome. Good work. Keep up the good work.
Yeah.
I think there are two valuable parts to that. One is, I think the first thing about this fertile ground is understanding what's good and what's not good. So we have the six perfections. You can carry them around in your hip pocket and refer to them as, you know, what the qualities of your attention and your activity are. So there's generosity. And you can see if there's generosity, there's ethics, you know, not doing any harm to yourself or others. There's patience. I promise you, when I'm angry, there's a lack of patience. There's no doubt. There's joyful diligence, like keeping at it. Am I keeping at it? There's meditation. Obviously, it's that part about returning to the cushion. And then there's wisdom, which is that last part that I just aspire to. So you keep that around, and you've got a fundamental way of understanding if you're going the right direction or the wrong direction. If you're going in one of those directions, it's a good chance it's going to wind up making a positive imprint on your mind. It has something to do with creating causes and conditions and karma. And if you're not, there's a good chance you're creating a negative impression in your mind, which is also creating karma and causes and conditions for the future. So there's that. And the other thing is, about me at least, there are repetitive habits that are bad. When I'm mindful, I regard them as annoying relatives that show up at my house. And because they're familiar, I let them in the front door, but then I let them out the back door as soon as possible. Because, you know, it's like I have repetitive thought too. It's just by judging them through the filter of the six perfections, I know whether they're a relative I want to hang out with or not. And if not, they come, they go. That's it. I do not serve them tea, as the Zen saying said. We're really late. If anybody needs to go, please don't stand on ceremonies. And Winnie, if you want to ask a question, feel free. I'm not going anywhere.
Yes, sorry. This is like a digression, but you know how Renee Zollinger said to Jerry Maguire, you had me at hello?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, when you said that we are enjoying our privileged life in America because of our merit from past lives,
yep.
You lost me at that. And I didn't hear a single other thing you said because my brain exploded. So it's really that I read a book called Justice, and it was a survey of Western philosophy, each chapter starting with Socrates, like going through Hume and John Stuart Mill's. And basically, our main belief about justice is good things happen to good people, and bad things happen to bad people. We want it to be that way, and we believe it's that way. So when Buddhists, not just at KTC, but other groups also, use the word rebirth to support that idea, and it's really like a fundamentalist idea and not really what Buddhism teaches. Buddhism would teach you do good, practice virtue just because that's the way to live, but you have to let go of results. You're adding to the tipping point, but you may or may not see results in your life. And on the other hand, I read a book called Out of America. And it's a journalist who was a New York Times reporter for Africa. He traveled from country to country, and each chapter is about a different country. In each country he went to, it was more and more tragic, the corruption, the poverty, the mass murders. And by the end of the year, and he was black, he said, "Thank God my relatives were captured into slavery, and I didn't grow up in Africa." So that's what I was thinking. Oh, so I just had to do it because it's Martin Luther King Day is tomorrow.
Yes. Well, I think if you're looking at one lifetime, what you say has a lot of merit. The idea that we're creating causes and conditions and that life and death are just a series of doors, bardos, if you will, and that this livingness that we are in, this flow of life, doesn't have a beginning or an end. That's where those ideas of karma come from. It's not really fundamentalistic. I mean, but it doesn't necessarily say that everything appears in one lifetime or all at once. Shanti Deva had a great explanation when he was asked that very question. And he got off his teaching throne and went down onto the floor at Nalanda University when it existed. And there was like one of those big cockroaches they have in India crawling across the floor. And he put his foot over the cockroach. And he said, I could smash this cockroach. And if karma was as you think it is, I would be able to feel my own ribs cracking as my foot went down on this bug. And he said, but I don't. I could step on this cockroach. But it will cause an imprint that eventually will bring some suffering to fruition because I harmed another being. That's the fundamental teaching, but it doesn't happen all at once. That's why we need ethics. That's why we need justice. That's why we need all that stuff. It's not a matter of good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. It's just a matter of we, according to what Bokar Rinpoche says in this chapter, we're living in fortunate circumstances because in some past, in some world, in some universe, it doesn't even happen to be have to be this one, we exhibited some generosity. And we made aspirations to live in a place where we could hear the Dharma, where we could have good intelligence, where we could have enough physical health to be able to sit here for as long as we have and so on. Those are not to be taken for granted, and that's the point. And it's also the point that we need to be creating the causes and conditions for ourselves and others to also benefit in the same way. And we can't do that by being selfish. So, I mean, that's the fundamental thing. We just can't do it by being selfish. So, anyway, I've talked way too long. And so, thank you very much. Please, everybody, just in your heart, take a moment and dedicate the merit of being here together and hearing the Dharma so that all beings can let go of some selfishness and aspire to altruism. Thank you.